September 17, 2010, the Norris Group hosted its award-winning event, I Survived Real Estate 2010. The Norris Group assembled an incredible lineup of industry experts to discuss the state of REO from the inside. Topics included regulatory intervention and aftermath, bulk buying myths and facts, and the opportunities emerging for eager real estate professionals. 100% of the proceeds went to the Orange County affiliate of Susan G. Komen for The Cure. This event would not be possible without generous help from the following platinum partners: The Business Press, Foreclosure Radar, and Sean O'Toole, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, and President Bill Tan, Investors Workshops, and President Sean Watkins and Angel Bronskiest, Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration, and Bobby Alexander, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Berry, Claudia Buys Houses, Fry Wiles, the creative agency responsible for iSurvive2010.com, MVT Productions, who always provide our audiovisual needs, and White House Catering, who will provide the three-course meal for this black tie event. Visit iSurvive2010.com for more details and to watch the event video.
Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Can I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
I'd like to ask all of you this question.
Have you taken over again, Tommy?
No, but I would like to know the answer.
Okay.
Last year, we went through a major change in the auto industry. Major. Closed, I don't have any idea what the right number would be, but literally thousands of automobile dealerships throughout the United States.
Well, not that many because they all fought back and most of them got reopened, but
well,
go on.
No, since I'm talking to people right. That want to sell them, I'm not too far off.
Right.
So the bottom line is those dealerships are closed. They will not reopen as automobile dealerships. If you'll go to the places where they're located, I just picked one industry. What I think we do not face in America is the reality of major changes in our economic system. We talk about all of these things in what I call big circles, but the reality is in that small town in America, there will no longer be a need for that auto dealer or a need for that drugstore or a need for that shoe store. That doesn't mean that that's a bad thing. I think Walmart and that concept, Lowe's, I think these have been great things for the American economy. But it has changed the paradigm of this economy completely, and I think we completely act like it didn't happen. We come up with everything in the world and look like Never Never Land is in the future, but no, we have to restructure the way we think. Now I ask you for the solutions.
Well, I mean, the first thing that has to happen is...
What's the problem?
But
we've been going through change forever. I mean, when they invented light bulbs, the candlestick makers went out of business. When they invented the car, the horse raisers went out of business.
There's no problem as long as you agree that you go and sell that automobile dealership and maybe turn it right back into barrel.
I mean, the reason they were closed is because they shouldn't have been open in the first place.
I agree with you completely, Chris. But we still go around trying to tell everybody that dealership's worth $300,000. No, it's worth $50,000.
Absolutely. And that's one of the big problems. You're right. We are going through a transition. I would agree with you 100% on that. It's particularly on the consumer side of the cow. Now, this is a painful time. You think about we've lost 8 million people, 8 million jobs in the U.S. 5 million of those jobs, 2 million came from construction, 2 million came from manufacturing, 1 million came from retail. Those 5 million people are not going to find new jobs anytime in the near future. This is a social crisis, though not an economic one.
I understand.
And I know that sounds awful to say, but this economy can grow with the burden of those folks for a while. And it's a social issue. We need to deal with that socially, and I hope we make the right decisions on the social constructs. But I don't think economically it's a problem.
Have you read the book, The World is Flat?
Yeah, it's completely wrong.
It's completely wrong?
Completely wrong. He's a journalist. He's not an economist, and I wish you stopped pretending he was.
Oh man, I really like the book. Yeah. Now, let's go ahead. What would be the concept that you think is completely wrong?
U.S. incomes have been rising at the same pace for the last 45 years. China aside, has been completely the developed world has not been influenced the tiniest bit by China. Our lives have been made better because of these amazingly cheap products we get on a daily basis. And the vast majority of us, yes, there are some casualties, but for the vast majority of us, particularly these people in this room, our lives have been made spectacularly better by the rise of China. Now, if you go down to Mexico, it's a completely different story. They're the ones that got ran over. Why are the drug cartels taken over? Because their economy got run over by the SS China. Because they're the ones in the path of that battleship, but not us. The world isn't flat. Mexico, it got flattened.
Our real income has gone up.
Absolutely.
In the last 10 years.
Absolutely. Okay. On average, a vast majority of Americans are far better off. Yes, the bottom 20% have been struggling forever, but even there, their standard of living has been more or less flat. I mean, today we got one horrible news. There's all these millions of people who are in poverty in the United States. Poverty in the United States means having an apartment, a car, television, free public education, and a decent amount of health care. I know it's hard to believe, but we got a lot of public health care in this nation.
Now, I remember...
It's really not, you know, give me a break. Will you go live in Somalia? You want to hear if you have tough times.
So you're not concerned about... Okay, and this is one of my legitimate concerns about when you have inflation... Let's say, and that ends up happening, but you don't have the ability to ask for more for the car that you were going to build because somebody has an import that's half of what you could do it for. How does that not have an impact? They just have to find another industry that's...
Yeah, change.
Change.
I mean, it's just change. Right? The world's all about change, and the change can come from trade, it can come from technology. Again, look at all the candle makers who lost their jobs because of the light bulb. Why are you going to hold back progress? No, we can't have the light bulb. There's all these guys have this wonderful pension. If you don't buy candlesticks, they're going to lose their pension. I don't care about their pension. Give me the light bulb.
All right, you brought up pension twice. Next time I'm going to ask you about it. I just finished reading a couple books. I think it was On the Brink and something, the Big Short, okay? Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is what you just said. All of this big chart is commercial mortgage-backed securities. Mm-hmm. Are there any collateralized debt bets against that stuff?
Are there any what?
Collateralized debt obligation bet. I'm sorry, CDSs.
CDOs.
Yeah, well, weren't they able to bet against...
Yeah, sure.
Is that a concern? I mean... Seems like it should be.
You know, I know they're weapons of map. What do they call them? Weapons of mass destruction. The whole market. And you know, is it a problem?
Well, wait a minute. Was it a problem for the residential world?
No. There's two different issues here.
Okay.
There's the real world and there's Wall Street.
Okay.
And when everything went to hell in a handbasket in 2007, it was because we had big problems in Wall Street and we had big problems in the real world. The problems in the real world, people were spending too much money on homes they couldn't afford, and they were spending too much money they weren't saving, and they were creating this huge trade deficit. That's the real world. The financial world, these guys were playing this Russian roulette, going crazy, leveraging up, making tons of money, and when it all blew up, they said, thank you much for our billions, and they walked away. That's just the greatest train robbery in the history of the United States, and we need to prevent that. But that's different from the real world. Don't confuse those two issues.
Okay. No, well, I don't want to say that that train wreck isn't ready to occur again if there's those kind of side bets again.
Absolutely, possibly, yeah. But I mean, it's all, you know, we have to do something to control the volatility and Wall Street. There's no doubt about it. It's not just those side bets. It's this, you know, millisecond trading where they're all trying to go at the speed of light, and we get these flash crashes, and it's this thing, this commercial. Mortgage-backed security crap. Who needs that? We never had that before. We had plenty of bubbles. But no, we needed that to have a world-class bubble. You know what I mean? We couldn't have bubbles without that, right? I mean, give me a break. This stuff should go away. We don't need that stuff.
Well, now, you seem like it was helpful to the industry.
I think it was extremely helpful. I mean, CMBS came in 1995.
Yeah, but we had commercial real estate markets before then, right?
We had
developed in the 80s, developed in the city, right? We built Empire State Building.
We lost several sources. The savings loans went out. A lot of the life companies went out. The banks weren't lending. You know, we had no debt available to us in 1995. So, gee, that was a great thing that we don't have any debt available to us. Well, somehow we had to create some debt for commercial real estate. The CMBS came on, and throughout the end of the 90s and probably into 2002, 2003, it was a really good thing. It was before the advent of the CDOs, using the CDOs to take the BP Spire out of the equation. Prior to that, you had someone who was actually taking a risk making a bet that that mortgage would do. And somebody watched
I'm
it.
I'm really talking more on the CDO side. So
right.
I apologize
yeah.
if I emphasized yeah. during that.
But the CDO came about, and then nobody had risk in the table.
Yeah.
And that went away, and then the CMBS market just went crazy. Too much debt came in, which created too much value, and you know, it was kind of the snowball that was on its way to explosion.
I mean, I really think you had two things that changed the risk. You know, right? We repealed Glass-Steagall.
Right.
Right. So we let federally insured banks start playing, you know, these games and play with mortgage-backed securities, play with all these new toys, right? All these shiny new toys. And then the Commodities Futures Modernization Act that'll let all these guys pretend they had insurance. Right? So now they have to go out and create as many risky products as they can with no risk themselves. Because at the end of the day, it all comes back to the taxpayer.
If I will, I agree with you 100% on that, except for we also have to keep something in mind, that the three biggest losses to the American taxpayer are not insured banks. It's Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and AIG.
So far, right?
So far. But those are the three biggies that in terms of taxpayer money. And none of that, all those came out from a different part and weren't insured at all and were picking up the tab
anyway.
But that's
only because we've given those big banks essentially free money, interest-free money, right? Let them go out and generate profits again and let them not take any losses. Let them push through all the losses and then let's see where the big losses really are.
But if you... Yeah, but Fannie and the size of Fannie and Freddie... If you just look at the sheer size of Fannie and Freddie, I mean, they're like the whales in the land of these. I mean, they're the
one one-hundredth, one one-thousandth of the total derivative.
Yeah,
bets
but
out
in
there?
Terms of sheer financial weight, the trillions and trillions of dollars they represent of debt in the system and over leverage in the system is just enormous. They dwarf the commercial banks in terms of their sheer size, and so even a 2% loss on a Fannie and Freddie is equal to wiping out half the commercial system.
But you have bets on those losses, right, in the derivatives markets.
My point is the taxpayer is still picking up the tab. And it has nothing to do with insured banks. All the way around, we were overexposed to these giants who were too big to fail.
So the banks have no derivatives products that they have potential liability on.
I don't know what that has anything to do with what I just said, but anyway. Okay.
Well, but that's my point, right? So if banks have derivatives, et cetera, that they potentially pay on in certain situations, which we don't know.
Well, I mean, derivatives in a limited form are worthwhile. I mean, I think
right.
that if you're going to get involved in the derivative, you should own the underlying asset the derivatives will leverage against. You shouldn't be allowed to go out and just throw out
random bets.
But we deregulated
them and we didn't do that.
Right. Now, I agree with that. There should be controls on the system, but what I'm trying to say is only part of the
we
problem.
We might be losing the audience, but I want to... So what's...
Lost. Lost. Yes.
No, this is a pretty sharp group. But, okay, explain what a derivative is and why it can get out of hand if that's... I don't care who takes that on.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, derivatives is where you're basically taking a side bet in the financial system, right?
Right.
So if I'm going to buy a bond, but then I need to insure myself against a failure of this bond, I may go out and buy a CDS on that. And that way, if this fails, I'm okay because I'm balanced over here. And I can see that kind of detraction. The problem is if I buy this and then these four guys all start buying it. And the problem was is there are so many cross bets going on in the system. Now, even that's not bad because you could say, oh, it creates a complete market. The problem with the idea of a complete market is it assumes the counterparty risk is zero. And what that means is no matter what, you get paid back.
Right.
There are other parts of the system right now which has fundamental insurance. The stock market, for example, the whole point of the New York Stock Exchange is they basically insure the transactions. If your counterparty collapses, there's somebody there to make sure that you're made whole, and that's what keeps the market liquid. The problem in these derivatives is we didn't have that. And so if you had, you know, we had the failure of Lehman, what it did was it sucked down a huge part of this derivative market. Suddenly there's no counterparty. And that's what creates a complete lockdown, total panic of the financial markets, blood running in the street. Next thing you know, nobody can get a loan for anything at all.
Chris, let me try just one more here. So think fire insurance on my house. I can buy fire insurance for my house. It protects me if my house burns down. Okay? What if everybody happens to know I'm a pyro? Right? I'm lighting off fireworks and I'm going crazy with fire every time. And everybody can take insurance against me losing my house when they know I'm a pyro.
That's the wrong example, because what if I know you live in a house made out of straw?
And
that's
I'm a
dry. and you keep a garage full of turpentine.
Right.
And I buy insurance in your house, and maybe I just happen to drop a cigarette next to your garage one day. That's
probably closer.
Yeah.
All the people, though, that bought that insurance policy, if there was a backing to that or a reserve to that, we wouldn't have the problem. The problem AIG
counterparty
did
risk.
Is they were making all these policies, but they had no reserve, no backup for it.
Right.
So it all went down.
Because if they had, if they were being forced to have a proper amount,
right,
they would have charged a lot more for it, which would have prevented this problem from happening,
right,
in the first place. So it's all boils down to counterparty risk. Too big to fail. That's what needs to go.
I just want to put, you know, this is a tough thing maybe to kind of get your head wrapped around, but this is the core of the whole deal.
Okay.
This is how we got this huge run-up in debt and how we got this huge run-up in prices.
Let me just, and we're going to close the first section with this. When my daughter got married, it was the first time I understood a credit default swap. It's a weird way to find out. Where she got married, they sent me the bill, and they sent this thing that you could insure against, like, what if your wedding didn't happen? You're writing this big check in advance. So I went for it because it was 1%, and I filled out the application, and it got to, okay, who are you in the transaction? And I'm the father of the bride, but there were a few other choices, including other. And I thought, how interesting. I wonder if they would cash 1,000 other checks on the bet that Sarah Norris's wedding didn't take place, and those guys didn't write the original check. And the answer is, some insurance, whatever, they look and say, this is a profitable business model, cash all 1,000 checks for one wedding, you'll be fine. That's literally what the system did, only the problem is Wall Street purposely put bad stuff in some of those and bet against it and became very wealthy. What was really distressing about some of these books is both sides became wealthy that made the bets. The people that bet wrong were on commission, and they were making tens of millions of dollars knowing they were going to lose people's money. And the people that bet right made tens and hundreds of millions of dollars, but on a device that wasn't allowed. It used to be called Bucket Shop in the early 1900s. All right, hopefully we've had a fun first half, and we'll thank you. All right, we're going to start our second half of the program, and I'm joined here with Peter Wayman, Freddie Mac, and Sarah Letts, Fannie Mae, and we're going to talk about a little bit about the trends of the inventory that's gone on in the last year, and maybe what you guys might be seeing in 2011. I might just mention a little bit about the audience, because this is not a normal audience, honestly. You already know it's not a normal panel, but the audience is, I am without a doubt, I would say the net worth in this room is approaching $500 million. I would say that there's definitely several thousand homes owned free and clear. There's a lot of years experience here. And so there's a lot of business potential, and we're very interested in the subject, bulk buying. So I think the first thing I'll say is, do bulk buys really happen? Because we're all suspicious, I can tell you.
They really happen. Yeah, there's a bid, and there's only one winning bidder, so I think that's why it feels like they don't happen very often. But
oh, we have to bid?
We have to bid.
Okay. Sarah, the quantities of inventory that you deal with, now are there multiple departments within Fannie Mae that do bulk, or is it just yours now?
There's one department now that's doing bulk sales, but we do two different kinds of bulk sales.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and typically what is the quantity, let's say, that somebody has to buy? We'll get back to this, but I'm just curious. What is the bulk buy quantity?
When it's a traditional pool, and those are typically the properties that didn't sell in our retail execution, and
right,
then they didn't sell at auction, we feel like the best execution is going to be a pool sale. And those are typically 100, 200, 300 properties in the pool, and people don't get to cherry pick which properties they want. They have to bid on the entire pool.
Okay. Now, you and I had talked about a quantity that was something much different, I thought. Is there a program available for smaller quantities?
Definitely. So,
okay.
And that's what I specialize in, and that is when we sell, it is basically cherry picking, but it has to have more of a mission orientation.
Okay.
So, one thing that Fannie and Freddie talk about a lot is the neighborhood stabilization strategy that both companies have, and we're trying to match up with what HUD is trying to accomplish with their $6 billion they've put on the street with the neighborhood stabilization program. So I partner with cities, counties, land banks, nonprofits to try to identify properties in our inventory, and they can be anywhere in our inventory from not even listed yet to aged inventory, and then we can pull together a pool, and the purpose of the pool is to really meet their neighborhood stabilization strategy.
Does that reach the private investor very often?
Occasionally, but not that often.
Not that often.
Yeah.
Can that be changed? And if it can be changed, what would we have to do?
Well, so far when it has reached to the private investor, it's been a private investor that has a good relationship with local government and is using government resources like redevelopment monies or the NSP monies, or they're using some form of down payment assistance. So they're using some form of public monies to implement the city's or the county's objectives.
Okay, I mean, I really think this is very important because you've really just given us a path that we can try and accomplish.
Right.
Because a lot of times, we get a tape and it's meaningless. We all look at 100 properties that never amounts to anything. So, Peter, what about on your side? Now, you and I have talked and kind of made fun that you really don't prefer to sell all your inventory to investors. We're not the first person on the food chain.
Right. I mean, the reality is it's less than 0.5% of our inventory will go through bulk purchases.
Correct.
That's because we start with the mission, which is giving the first look to neighborhood stabilization organizations using the NSP funds and trying to take assets, and those are typically ones that need a lot of renovation, and put them back in the hands of people that are going to do something with that using public funds. Then we use the first look to put an owner-occupant into the property. And we use that retail execution because the realtor community is excellent in getting the home sold. And as a result, 85% of all of our properties will sell and close in that 90 to 120 day category at a very good retail recovery. And I know that all of these people in this room are taxpayers as well. And, we are under conservatorship. And although we were called whales, I prefer to see myself as that Pacific Life whale that jumps up and leans back. But our goal is to maximize recovery through best execution. And, it's understandable that the investors are interested in getting the properties, and they are interested in best execution and dealing with returns as well. So that's why it is further down the food chain, mm-hmm. because these are properties that, probably weren't suitable for retail execution, didn't work through the auction process, and made their way down to the to the low recovery side.
The last look group, the investor. Okay.
The rocks and sticks.
Okay, fair enough. Now, what percentage of inventory ends up there? It's not a small percentage as far as what you and I talked about. Investors buy what percentage approximately?
Well, I mean, the reality is that it's still less than 0.5%.
Well, that's in the bulk, but I'm talking about overall.
Oh, investors, yeah. And investors are actually buying about a third of our property.
Okay. So, I mean, that's not insignificant. Obviously, there's a margin there, and it doesn't always have to be part of a bulk to make sense to either keep as a rental. Is there any financing on some of the purchases?
Not from us.
Not from you.
The other whale.
Okay. Now that's interesting.
Yeah, we have HomePath. Many property. Our website for listing properties and selling them via the retail execution is called HomePath.com.
Okay.
And a lot of them will qualify for our HomePath financing. And then we have another product. It's a HomePath financing for the properties that need to be rehabbed. So we do offer financing.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate 2010. 1M1 Properties, Adrenaline Athletic, Awesome Limousines, Benton Investment Group, Colonial Gardens Mobile Home Community, Community Reinvest Group, Del May Properties, Elite Auctions, Entrust California, Everlast Photography, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Keystone CPA, Landwood Title, Las Brisas Escrow, Lavis Financial Services, Mike Cantu, North San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Personal Real Estate Investor Magazine, Realty 411 Magazine, Summit Solutions, Tony Alvarez, TheREOMentor.com, WealthPoint, Westin South Coast Plaza. To find out more about I Survived Real Estate 2010, visit iSurvived2010.com.